Today's program was brought to you by Worldwide Soba, Restaurant Consulting, Noodle Factory, and Academy. For more information, visit worldwide-soba.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the main course without Patrick Martins. I am Alexis McLaughlin, here with Philip Gilmore.
Good morning.
We are very excited. We have on the show today Chef Todd Richards. Todd is the executive chef at White Oak Kitchen and Cocktail in downtown Atlanta. He has spent his culinary career in the fine dining world, earning himself numerous accolades, including being a semifinalist for the James Beard Award for Best Chef, as well as being named by Esquire as one of four new chefs to watch in 2012. Todd is now working on a new project, which is a departure from the fine dining world, and it's going to be opening up in spring. Richard's Southern Fried.
That is correct.
In Atlanta?
It is in Atlanta, and it's funny because fried chicken is so much revealed in this country, and I think that it blends itself to casual and fine dining at the same time.
Are you from Atlanta?
I'm from Chicago originally, but I went down to Atlanta in 92 for a party and didn't leave, you know.
Do you remember Bridgetown Grill?
Oh, yeah.
I was a bar manager at Bridgetown Grill.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in Little Five Points.
Yeah, you're showing your age, aren't you?
Yeah. Do you remember Deacon Burton's?
Yeah.
And then, so I didn't work at Deacon Burton's, but I worked at the patio.
Oh, wow.
That took over Deacon Burton's.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, I lived on the, I was only there for 2 years, like 98, 99.
Yeah.
But I lived in the building next to the Zesto's on Five Points.
Yeah. I live not too far from there on our old Fourth Ward, and it's something still about that area, you know, that it's so retro. It's such a icon spot of Atlanta that, you know, people are trying to change it, and the resistance of change is what makes it so fun and so popular to be around.
Actually, my friend Jerobi from Tribe Called Quest, who's also a chef, used to actually work at the Flying Biscuit.
Oh, Flying Biscuit, yeah. Well, if my gut can talk, you know, like, I can't even eat any more of those biscuits. Yeah. They're so good.
Yeah, right? he told me he'd give me the recipe for $1,000.
Everyone has a price, I guess. Yeah.
So where were you working in the 90s down there?
When I first started in Atlanta, I actually started butchering at Kroger. I was a butcher first, and I was really kind of lost in what I was wanting to do. I left Chicago. I was going to go to Georgia Tech. My idea was to be a physics and math major.
Wow.
And my goal is really to work on, like, nuclear submarines. That's really what, you know, that's kind of strange kind of goal to have, but I just thought it was so cool to be underwater, you know, have all that power in your hands and, you know, and do it. But it was really boring.
Yeah.
I was really bored with math and those things like that, and decided to get a job at Kroger, just happened to be in the meat department. And then from then, they wanted to start this whole program where you start cooking in the meat department, displaying food. There's another restaurant across the street I started working at, and I never looked back.
Wow.
Never looked back. I mean, the biggest part of my career at that time was I started working at the Four Seasons Hotel.
Wow.
And from there on.
In Atlanta,
yeah.
Is that in Buckhead or no?
It's in Midtown.
Midtown, that's right.
It was the Occidental at first, and then it went to the Four Seasons. And from there, you know, just walking in the kitchen, seeing guys with their big hats on and everything. And being from Chicago, there's a steakhouse called Lowry's Steakhouse. And when I was a kid, my parents took me there. And the guy would wheel this cart out with the big chef hat on, open up, and it's like prime rib, you know, and just baked potatoes and cream spinach and everything. And actually, every year I go to Chicago, I always make a trip by Lowry's Steakhouse because I think that's a way to pay homage to, you know, what got me started and helped me stay focusing on moving forward.
Wow.
Was moving to Atlanta an introduction to Southern food for you?
You know, I don't think it was a recognized introduction, because growing up in Chicago, where so many people migrated from the South, you know, to Chicago, we always had that element there. Mm-hmm. I think what going to the South really showed me was how to use ingredients seasonally compared to Chicago, where the winters are brutal, things don't grow, so we had to rely on things being brought in all the time. And I think that's the biggest change about living in the South, that it's such, you know, a great thing to understand agriculture and terroir and how things are changed. Like, I've seen Atlanta's terroir change so much over the course of years, where it's becoming more of a wine region now. People are actually, you know, planting vineyards there, and that population is expanding. I mean, look at the carrots that grow there. I don't think I've ever tasted a better carrot in my life, except for the ones that grow, you know, certain parts of Atlanta. So I just see those seasonal things happen so much more in Atlanta than I did growing up in Chicago.
Peaches.
You know, oddly enough, peaches are they grow more in South Carolina than they do in Georgia. They just taste better in Georgia, I think, you know.
How you know, with cuisine that's so established, like Southern food, Southern cuisine, how does that change? Is that a growing, you know, kind of genre? Or
that's
is
a
it
very
static?
Good question. You know, country wise, Southern food has exploded under different circumstances. You look at 9/11 that happened. And then you come to New York and you see more comfort food, more Southern-inspired food. You know, I was always making the joke that I used to go to New York to eat fried chicken, because there's more fried chicken in New York than it was, you know, in the South. And you see that happen, you know, you've seen it happen with the recession, where this big boom of Southern food comes about. And it seems like whenever the country needs to find its soul again, it returns back to Southern food. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the fabric of what food is, you know, in this country. And it's expanded, you know, mm-hmm. worldwide. And you have people, you know, looking at us as what is next, you know, and the thing about Southern food that I think people are finally understanding, that it's more sophisticated and it requires a lot more instructional management in order to do it properly. It's not just a pinch of this or a pinch of that. It actually takes time. And the South has changed a great deal, too, in its embracement of industrial revolution. You know, a lot of the practices we have in the South are, you know, prior to industrial revolution, where there's no refrigeration, so things like fried chicken, which is a preservation method, you know, really comes about. It tastes delicious, but it's actually a preservation method, you know. And, you know, things like country hams, you know, you come up here, you see bins, you know, everywhere, and you understand that it's a preservation method. So these are all things that were really prior to industrial revolution that has affected the country as a whole.
So your main restaurant, do you take, obviously you're inspired by Southern food, but do you also take from like other countries and cuisines?
Well,
I think delve into like Japanese or Italian or,
I look at, Atlanta in as the bridge place of all things Southern, because everyone comes there and everything comes. The railroad comes there. You know, the plane, of course, you know, it's the busiest airport in the world. But we borrow a lot of those techniques in order to make Southern food. I don't think Southern food is specific to one thing. I think it is a combination of everything blended together.
Yeah.
And to do it very well takes a lot of research and takes a lot of appreciation of other cultures in order to get there. A good example is that, you know, in Georgia, we grow a lot of soybeans. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what's that, you know, what is the basis of soy sauce? I mean, it's soybeans, yeah. You know, so to understand that process of making soy sauce and to understand that you have soybeans growing here, that makes sense to me in the Southern culture and the Southern diaspora.
Yeah, of course.
You know? So we borrow a lot of things, you know.
Use any tobacco?
You know, when I was in Louisville, we did use a lot of tobacco. And tobacco was one of those things that really started to be one of those new ingredients, as you say, of the year. But we, you know, we used it quite often, you know, when I was in Louisville.
How do you use tobacco in cooking?
Well, dry it and smoke it.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we ever put that on the plate. But, but you know, we'll do things like we actually would dry it and smoke it, and, you know, infuse flavor into some meats and fish and things like that. We used to wrap fish in the leaves and bake it and things like that. So it's not as harsh or as carcinogenic as people would think, you know, when you do it in a natural process.
Interesting. How long were you in Louisville for?
I was in Louisville for 5 years. I was at the Silback Hilton Hotel and ran the Oak Room, which still is a AAA Five Diamond restaurant. So it was really an honor to run one of the 42 or 44 in the world to achieve that, you know, for five straight years. I mean, it's...
What kind of food were you serving there?
Some people might say it's fine dining. I think that it was...
French-American-ish?
I think it was more southern inspired. Oh, really? And definitely more regional. The paddlefish craze that hit the country of caviar really started in Louisville.
Yeah.
You know, so we used a lot of that. A lot of things like pawpaws, which are, you know, domestic mangoes, and in a sense we use that. But we then, you know, started going to Appalachia and looking at like ginseng that grew there and ginger that grew in Appalachia, which most people wouldn't have imagined that ginseng grows, you know, in that region. But it was really phenomenal, and really understanding how things grow, you know, was really a great deal. And then, of course, you know, the produce and, you know, pork was king in Louisville. So we got some really great items to come in. And then chicken really exploded in Louisville at that time as well. So we were able to use those.
When was this, like early 2000s?
This is 2004 to 2008, I think.
Awesome, great.
Yeah.
Cool. I know I want to ask you to kind of retell what makes... good fried chicken. You had your
your
tips.
My tips are good fried chicken. Well, you know, like I always tell everyone, the first thing you have to do is really buy really great chicken, you know, and you really can't not start with that. Sometimes you go and you'll see people with chicken and the bag is sticky and all that stuff, and I'm like, you know, first of all, you're going to kill everybody, so that's not going to make good, you know.
Put the salmonella down.
Right, you know. But we look at it, you know, at really quality people, really quality sources. We use a lot of local sources, of course, naturally, and that's really part of the programs that I like to do, because I like to know the people actually that we're buying our products from. You know, not only with chicken, but with vegetables and everything, I have to know them. I have to have a relationship with them. I know most of their kids and everything. Because people are counting on me not only to provide them a really delicious food, but also make sure that they're safe and wholesome and everything like that. So, you know, like, you know, we use Springer in for our chicken, but it's really about quality and taste to start with. I think, you know, there's a lot of other tips that tell people, you know, about time and temperature and everything. But, that to me is the most important thing, is buying, the quality product that you want to start with. I think the other thing that people should really look at with really great fried chicken is making sure you have enough time to do it. You know, brine the chicken. You know, a simple solution of salt and water can really affect the quality of your fried chicken. A couple other tips I tell people is, you know, you want a little bit more crunchy. For every four cups of flour, we always add one tablespoon of cornmeal to give it some extra crunch. And then my last tip, which is not really a secret, but I tell the people it's a secret, so it sounds more interesting, is that you got to fry more chicken than you actually plan on eating, because the only thing better than hot fried chicken is cold fried chicken the next day.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know what I tell people is we have a pretty – I own a Japanese restaurant next door, and we do pretty, pretty traditional Japanese fried chicken. Mm. And so sometimes people will order too much food and they get something to go. Mm. And we do boneless, skinless thigh meat.
Mm-hmm.
And we brine it, and, you know, it's super crunchy. And I tell them, please, whatever you do, do not heat this back up.
No, never.
And also, too, what I suggest they do is take it and then chop it up and use it like chicken for chicken salad. Because there is almost nothing better than cold fried chicken salad.
I mean, it's crazy. And it has its own mind of its own. And from, you know, from a scientific background that I like to use sometimes, you know, when you fry something, it expands. expands, you know, so all the flavors get expanded. Mm-hmm. But when it gets cold, all those flavors get compressed mm-hmm. back together again. So every bite, every morsel has all this compressed flavor yeah. back inside of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that cold fried chicken and a glass of champagne, I mean, you know.
Breakfast.
You know, almost every day, you know. I hope my doctor's not listening. But
that's really funny you mentioned that, because I actually, you know Blue Ribbon, of course,
yes,
Blue Ribbon Restaurant. Mm-hmm. And this is probably about 10 years ago. I was there twice in 1 year. Mm-hmm. And both times, you know the rapper Fabulous?
Yeah.
So both times, mm-hmm. He was there, and he was sitting at the same table, same mm-hmm. position, mm-hmm. with about 5 or 6 people. And both times, you know, because they have one of the best fried chickens mm-hmm. in New York City. But he was literally drinking $800 bottle of champagne mm-hmm. and the fried chicken. I'm like, God, that's such a great combo. But I saw him twice, the same, you know, same, but like months apart.
Well, you know, it is a great combination, you know, and I think that you know, chicken is that universal source of food for millions and probably billions of people.
Yeah.
And I think it deserves celebration,
yeah.
you know, and I think when it's done right, it deserves even more celebration. And I can't think of any way to celebrate anything more than with a glass of champagne, you know?
Of course.
How long was Richard Southern Fried kind of in your brain and
that's a really good question. You know, I always showed up with fried chicken as part of the cuisine, even in, you know, Oak Room of, you know, Five Diamond Restaurant. You know, we had a 12 and 20 course tasting menu, I think, at that time. You know, it's really kind of crazy to think about that, you know, 20 courses. But, you know, fried chicken always showed up there because I think that it is essentially the most American food there is. And, you know, when I took over at the Ritz-Carlton Buckhead, and I was listening to the comments of the guests that they thought they loved the hotel, they loved the restaurant, but they did not get a taste of what they thought Southern food was.
Yeah.
And I said, well, maybe we should do the most example of Southern food, you know, and we did that there. And then we went and competed because, you know, in competitions, a lot of fundraisers and things like that. So we always brought it with us, and people loved it, and everyone loved it. But I still don't think that it really came into fruition until last year. And last year, I really just wanted to look. I'm looking at my career and my life, and it's like, you know, I'm getting a little old to be on the line, you know, every single minute. And I really want to leave a mark that is also making a statement. And I thought that if I can open the fried chicken space and have more people come and more people sit down and have more conversations about the world, that we can change the world through one bite at a time. And I figured that if I'm going to do it, I want to do something that has more meaning to me and hopefully to other people than just to have another restaurant opening. Mm.
That's amazing. Jinx.
where are you getting your chickens from?
Well, we got chickens from Springer Mountain, you know, and they're a local company, and I really love them because they're honest about what they do, mm-hmm. you know, and to provide quality chicken to masses of people that, you know, that is raised in a proper manner. And I'm not going into the political side what's proper and not proper. I just know that I went to the farm, I saw the chickens, mm-hmm. I saw how they were treated, and I felt good.
Yeah.
And to me, that's all I can ask for, is mm-hmm. that, you know, I don't want somebody to pull the curtain behind and see the, you know, the Wizard of Oz, you know, really there. You know, I want to know.
Kicking chickens.
Right, you know. I want to know, you know, the same regards, you know, that whole everyone else, you know, responsible for. Mm-hmm. The shrimp guy that we use, I know him. I know his wife. I know his kids, you know. Mm-hmm. But chicken is one of those things that has to be mass-produced because it feeds so many people.
Yeah.
And when I went there, I was like, well, damn, you know, somebody's actually caring about the customer, because if you care about the customer, then you can only do it the right way.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is what's important.
Well, you know, I get these, I have a place next, I have two restaurants next door, but one of them focuses on yakitori, mm-hmm. which, of course, is, you know, the grilled mm-hmm. chicken skewers, and we get these La Belle Rouge chickens mm-hmm. from Heritage Foods, mm-hmm. and we did an event a few weeks ago, and we got some, somebody gave us some chickens, and the chickens they gave us are these amazing pasture-raised chickens, mm-hmm. but we had them side by side, and mm-hmm. so the chickens that were donated for the event mm-hmm. were beautiful, pasture raised, organic, home-raised, but standing next to the La Belle Rouge chicken, it was amazing. They looked like different creatures because La Belle Rouge, like the meat is darker and
yeah,
it's
the
like
color and
the color, even on the bone, is like it's kind of looks like, you know, almost red, and it's just there's something like really good chicken. There's nothing better.
Well, I think that people don't. You know, average customer does not know that there are many different types of chickens, you know, and they all serve their different purposes and different cooking techniques and everything. You know, when you get a chicken like that, you know, we treat it more like duck than we would actually, you know, chicken. I just think that for the masses of people that we know that rely on this bird, that if it's raised correctly in order to feed the masses of people, then they feel better about it.
Well, it also tastes different, too. Like, you know, if you have, like, you know, inside of a two-story building and, like, you know, mass produced, it's like the air they're breathing, the water they're drinking, even have their emotions, you know, it's like all that translates into the bite, too, you know?
Well, it translates into a lot more things, you know, for myself and my staff is because we, as chefs, we don't actually see people, you know. We see people as numbers and as letters and things like that. So we have to fight ourselves, you know. It has to be something inside you that says, I have to serve the best, and you don't even know who you're serving it to.
But you know that you're proud of the thing that they're eating, even though you don't see them.
Right. Exactly. And that's what, you know, the story
sleep
is.
Makes you sleep better at night.
Well, that, and of course, another glass of
champagne.
Yeah. But it really does. It does make a difference, you know.
Uh-huh. Let's go ahead and take a quick break, and then we'll get back to talk more with Chef Todd Richards.
Awesome.
This track is Dreams by Taxstar. We'll be right back on Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Main Course without Patrick Martins on heritageradionetwork.org. If you are just tuning in, we are speaking with Chef Todd Richards.
Fried chicken guru.
Fried chicken master. And you're going to be at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival.
That is correct.
We're going to be there too. Heritage Radio Network is going to go down, do some coverage.
That's great. It's one of my favorites to do. Well, all of them are my favorites, but that one, it seems like I see a lot more of my friends at that festival than anything else. And we're cooking with Dwayne Nutter from One Flew South and Craig Deal from Cypress.
I know Craig.
Yeah, he's a really great guy, you know. And we're actually doing a dinner on Goat Island. So we're doing a live fire dinner outside on the island. No stoves, you know, no broilers, no nothing like that. We're building a pit, and we're going to actually cook outside. You know, hopefully it doesn't rain, but, you know, we're building.
When is it?
Charleston Food One is first weekend of March.
Oh, cool.
I think it's the 4th through the 7th, somewhere around that time. And it's going to be a crazy event for us.
That's awesome. I guess that's primitive cooking. That's really exciting. Is that open to, I don't know how it works. Is it open to people? Is it like a ticket thing?
It is a ticket thing. Fortunately and unfortunately that our event sold out within, I think, 2 minutes. So the pressure, you know, went up just a little bit once you hear that, you know, and like, okay, we're on an island and we have no fire and everything, and we're supposed to produce this fabulous meal for about 100 people and, you know, go. You know, it's like, okay, well, we'll figure out as we go, but it's going to be exciting.
Have you guys sorted out the menu? Do you have experience, like, I don't know, primitive cooking?
Well, I have experienced a lot with smoke, you know, with smoking meats and things like that. And I'm really counting on that experience, you know, to do so, knowing how to move heat around and get things, the results I want from that mm-hmm. way. So I think I might have a little bit easier time in doing so. I do know that Dwayne and Craig have gotten a couple more gray hairs recently in conversations about it, because we have to do, like I said, we have to build everything. But I think we'll be all right and have a good time.
I think if you just stock up on, like, cases of champagne and worst goes to worst, just get everyone really drunk and then
that typically happens anyway when you get all three of us involved. I think we drink a lot of whiskey together, which is quintessential good smoking, you know, meats and fish food. You know, whiskey is good for that. But I think that we're really just going to go out there, build a pit, you know, start a fire and really just have a good time, and then let 80 of our closest friends show up and tell us how fabulous we are. You know?
It's a good event.
Yes.
What else are you looking forward to
for the festival? I'm really looking forward to seeing the Waffle House Challenge. You know, ooh. Waffle House Challenge is iconically Southern. And
do you know the Waffle House?
I mean, I know the Waffle House. Yeah. That's like a 3 a.m.
Yeah.
hotspot. But what, I don't know what the Waffle House Challenge
well,
is.
Well, basically, is they recreate the Waffle House on stage, and then they have, you know, chefs come up there and compete on trying to reproduce a meal from Waffle House.
Like short order, scattered.
Scattered,
smothered, slathered, splattered.
What is it?
Smothered, scattered, covered.
Let's see if I can remember all. Scattered, smothered, covered, chunked, diced, shroomed, topped. And I think I'm missing one other, but that's about all of it, you know?
Wow.
You know? And so, you know, you see chefs up there really trying to do that, and it's such
a... Now, is it trying to make it as authentic as possible reinventing it?
No, as authentic as possible.
Wow.
I mean, and you have a server there actually calling out the order to them, so they have to try to remember. You know, we get tickets, you know, so we get to see, and someone sitting there hollering at you.
It sounds like a nightmare, but so much fun.
Yeah, but it's so much fun laughing at someone else because I'm not up there on the stage, you know?
That's amazing.
You know, and see... You know, And I'm glad they don't ask me to do it, because I would practice. I would practice so much. I would be at home every day practicing this thing, even if I knew I had to do it. You know, I wouldn't. I hate losing. You know?
It's a lot of hash browns to be eating.
Yeah, you know. And, you know, it's funny. One of our dishes on the menu, we look at things like Waffle House as icons of the South, and how to recreate that, you know, memory for people. And so we have a new sandwich that we have on our lunch menu. It's slab bacon, fried egg, fried green tomato, pimento cheese, and a huckleberry jam. And then we make black truffle hash browns to go with it.
Wow.
And the service tell people, say, hey, this is just a recreation of his experience at Waffle House that he loves so much. And that dish is crazy. We sell so much of it. But it's a fun thing to eat, you know, and for lunch, you know, you come in, you have sit down and you have a good sandwich and some hash browns and some, you know, $200-pound truffles on top of it, you know, and, you know, you just enjoy yourself. You know?
Nice decadent meal.
What do you think about Eats? Eats is jerk chicken.
You know, I'm a big fan of jerk chicken.
It's my favorite, probably my favorite food.
You know, and, you know, it's just something about it, you know, the spice, the crispy, the skin, you know, that skin, when it gets so crispy, I mean, it's magical.
You have to go to Peppa's.
I haven't been.
It's probably the best I've ever had.
Oh, wow.
And you go in, it looks like they bought a, like, bombed out, like, Chinese restaurant and then took everything off the walls. Mm-hmm. It's just literally nowhere to sit, just a counter.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's something.
I remember going to Jamaica and having jerk chicken, and it was
out of the oil can.
Yeah, and it was something about the fire. You know,
because they have the special. What is? I can't even remember what kind of wood is it. It's
I don't know.
It's pimento wood.
Yeah, okay.
It's pimento wood. They use a special wood. So supposedly, you know, I've never actually. I can order it online, but it's kind of expensive. But I've never had it that they use all pimento wood.
I mean, it was something magical about it. You know, the smoke tastes so much different, and it's funny how chefs are always trying to look for something different, and how smoke is part of that conversation. I mean, everyone's
on charcoal.
Yeah, everyone's on charcoal now. You know, I mean, charcoal is one of the biggest things that's been made its renaissance in kitchens. But you know, understand Japanese cooking. You know, charcoal is big there, and you see it popping up everywhere in ice creams and things like that. So you can see how we always look for a unique flavor, but we always go back to the original and start all over again.
What are some trends that you've seen kind of in your generation as a chef emerge, or what do you think is going to be, you know, the hallmark of our cuisine kind of now as it stands when we're looking back at it?
Well, I believe that cuisine is really at a great juxtapose. Because there's more people on the earth, and where there's more people, there's more critical mass and critical thought about how we're going to feed people. So I think that in the political realm of legislation, you're going to see the fight between GMO and non-GMO foods take a big, a big fight, both politically, ethically, and all those things like that. And I don't know which is right or which is wrong. I mean, certainly I don't believe in those things. However, I do understand is that the population keeps growing. We're going to run out of food some way, somehow. We have to find another way to produce it. So I think that's going to be a big trend and a big fight that we're going to see. I think that food-wise, I think that you're going to see smaller restaurants be the focus much more going on. I think that there are so many... it's so hard to open a big restaurant right now. Real estate prices and everything like that has priced itself out of what can be a successful restaurant. I think that you'll see more chefs do more casual concepts for that same reason also with real estate. And I think that you will find more celebrations in American food. And American food will be more defined by all ethnic groups and not just one single group. I think that you'll start seeing people pull more from things and more smash-ups on the plate. And I don't think it will be in that fusion realm, because fusion realm was still, you could still really identify where the fusion came from. I think this will be more American, and you'll see so many different things on the menu that really takes place. You know, you'll see German, you'll see Mexican, you'll see Chinese, you'll see soul food, you'll see all those things come together all in one menu.
I'm really glad the fusion thing is kind of over. Well, I'm done with the Brazilian-Italian fusion.
You know, I understand it from an ingredient standpoint. I think that
I hate when people do it just to do something like so different. You know, like they're not doing it because they got inspired. They're doing it just because like Lithuanian Korean has never been done doesn't mean it should be done.
Right. Well, there's a reason why. You know, a lot of people might say that about you know things like molecular gastronomy. You know, where it's just done to be done. But and I really disagreed with that. I mean, in an example, when we were at the Oak Room, we had asparagus on our menu, and we did not use the bottoms because they're woody, and you know, no one really wanted it for compost because it doesn't make good compost and things like that. So we had to do something with them. So we would juice them and everything, and we may either encapsulate them, making a ravioli or something like that. So our playfulness was actually to use a product up instead of just throwing it away and pitching it to the wayside. So I can understand if people like it or don't like it, but to say that we, you know, people necessarily use that as a trend, I don't think that really what it was. I think at that point in time, people were trying to find their voice of artistic value to through food.
Yeah, of course.
I guess wrapping it up, but
so nice to meet you, man.
Yeah, appreciate it.
I'm so happy to talk to you about Atlanta too.
Yeah. You know, it's
kind of wish we could hang out and just talk.
Can you get some Easter chicken and get it to go, and then go over to the Flying Biscuit, and then get a Flying Biscuit, and then shove it in there, and then take it down to Elmir and make a burrito out of it.
Yeah, well,
and then Snapchat fill up the whole.
Oh my goodness! You know, I think you're talking about a trend. I mean, I think that. Social media is the biggest food trend ever. You know, I mean, you have to devote time and energy to do it, you know, as much as you do as training your wait staff and training your kitchen staff and ensuring food costs and labor costs. Social media is the biggest, you know, the fifth item on the list, mm-hmm. usually in most restaurants right now.
Yeah.
I just heard Pete Wells on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and he was talking about the effect of photography on food and that not, you know, sometimes to a detriment, chefs are preparing, food that photographs well kind of at the sake of its, flavor and everything else.
I do understand that. I do understand when I look at some dishes and you don't see any salt and pepper on it. You know, it's like, you see a salad with no olive oil or dressing on it.
Yeah.
And you're really like, okay, this is going to taste like crap, you know. But then there's, you know, chefs like myself who shoot things as live as possible. Most of the shots that we do are right there at the pass, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's really about giving people a glimpse into our kitchen, into our culture.
I mean, obviously, if it's a photo shoot for like a magazine or there's a film crew, right. You know, obviously, I'm going to, you know, take the microgreens and arrange them like specifically. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? Like for the photo, but I would never like change the, I want to shoot it how it comes, you know?
And it's really disappointing when you go to a restaurant after you've seen
exactly. it. Exactly. And then just slopped it on the plate.
Yeah, you know?
Like, this isn't like the photo.
I know, right?
Look at Instagram. This isn't what I ordered.
I know. And you have to be careful of that. We don't understand that. And to really understand it, you know, to the X, you know, it's the point of it is that we are insane. Chefs are the most craziest people in the world. I mean, you
pirates,
have to,
Vikings.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you have to think about that. You put art on a canvas and it leaves and you never get to see it again. Mm. You know?
Uh-oh, I think we're done. I think there's somebody that's kind of doing another radio show here.
Yeah.
Are you the guest on the next show? You don't even have to move, right?
Todd, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to meet you, man.
My pleasure.
Yeah, this is exciting. Thank you guys for listening. As always, find us on the web at heritageradionetwork.org. Donate if you like the shows. Follow us on iTunes and Stitcher.
Eat at Moku Moku.
Eat at Moku Moku.
Oh, by the way, we owe Makoto a commercial because he donated.
Okay.
Yes, for he wants to do a commercial for Samurai Mom. Like he gave a very generous donation, he told me.
Let's
do it.
Let's do that. And be on the lookout for Richard Southern Fried opening this spring in Atlanta. All right, thanks, guys.
Happy Sunday-ish.
Thank you all.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. I never had